Smith in the City by P.G. Wodehouse, dramatised by Marcy Cahan. Episode 3, Stirring Times with Comrade Waller.
Mike had begun to grow accustomed to the life of the bank and to find that it had its pleasant side. Whenever a number of people are working at the same thing, even though that thing is not perhaps what they would have chosen as an object in life, there is bound to exist an atmosphere of good fellowship. Adding to Mike's contentment was the presence of his friend, the indomitable Smith, working alongside him, his partner, in the steady flow of envelopes. This state of things was clearly too good to last. At the new year, Mike was moved to the cash department. Smith remained two aisles away in postage.
Comrade Jackson, how goes it?
I haven't made any major blunders so far. Mr. Waller is a good egg. He knows that I haven't a natural talent for banking, but he doesn't seem to mind.
But here you are, scratching away at a ledger. I expected to find you behind the main counter, while in fact it is Comrade Waller over there who is shooting doubloons at the grateful public.
That's Mr. Waller's job. He's the paying cashier.
And for this paltry work, they have deprived a man of his confidential secretary.
I'm afraid so. How is my successor in the dear old postage department getting on?
Comrade Bristow? He's about as near to the extreme edge as anything I've ever seen.
Why? What's he done?
He wears detachable cuffs.
Ah.
And a black moustache. And a ring.
You must bear it all with your customary fortitude, Smith.
Well said. As an energetic socialist, I do my best to think well of my fellow man. Mind you, Bristow's worst defect is that he is not you.
He can't help that.
It's hugely inconvenient. I evolved a slightly bright thought on life just now. I told it to Bristow. The fool gaped. I tell you, Comrade Jackson, I feel as Marshall would feel if they took Snellgrove away from him. Or as Peace might if he awoke one morning to find plenty gone. But there is worse to report.
Excuse me, Mrs.
Mr. Waller, at your service.
You must really let Jackson get on with his work.
Too much talk, my besetting sin. I was just about to enlighten Comrade Jackson about Comrade Bristow's latest outrage, a waistcoat that glitters like a sort of woolen sunset. But it will keep. It will keep.
Jackson, will you kindly take my place at the counter for a few minutes?
Of course, Mr. Waller.
Mr. Smith!
Hello again.
Mr. Smith, when you were talking to Jackson just now...
Say no more. It shall not occur again. I will bear Comrade Bristow like a man. After all, there are worse things at the zoo.
Oh, no. Pay us a visit now and then. Just be sure that Mr. Bickersdyke is not on the floor.
I shall be vigilant. Thank you.
Mr. Smith, I noticed just now that you spoke of Bristow as... Comrade Bristow.
Too true. I must correct myself of the habit. He will be getting above himself.
And when you were speaking to Jackson, you spoke of yourself as a, socialist.
Socialism is the passion of my life.
Oh, I am delighted. Really, I am delighted. I also...
A fellow worker in the cause.
But exactly. I have never liked to speak of it to anybody in the office, but I too am heart and soul in the movement.
Yours for the revolution.
Oh, just so. Just so. I was wondering, the fact is, I am in the habit of speaking on Sundays in the open air.
At Hyde Park?
No, Clapham Common. It is, handier for where I live. Now, as you are interested in the movement, I was thinking, perhaps you would care to hear me speak next Sunday?
I should like to excessively.
Oh, excellent. Bring Jackson with you, and both of you come to supper afterwards, if you will.
Thanks very much.
Perhaps you would speak yourself.
My socialism is rather of the practical sort. I seldom speak.
Ah.
What type of oratory is yours?
Oh, I am perhaps a little bitter.
Yes, good.
A little mordant and ironical.
Mordant and ironical is good. I shall look forward to Sunday with every fibre quivering.
The following Sunday, Smith and Mike ventured forth from their snug flat in Clement's Inn.
The first thing we must do, Comrade Jackson, is to ascertain that such a place as Clapham Common really exists.
I expect we could get there by tram.
A smith on a tram? Well, I think not. No, we will stroll gently after a light lunch to Trafalgar Square and hail a taxi.
Beastly expensive.
Can any expenditure be called excessive, which enables us to hear Comrade Waller being mordant and ironical at the other end?
I hope the dickens he won't mix us up in it. We should look frightful fools.
I may possibly say a few words if the spirit moves me.
Look here, Smith. If you're going to play the goat, don't go lugging me into it.
Your solid, incisive style would go down rather well with the masses. We shall see. We shall see.
Oh.
By the time they reached the common, Mike was in a state of nervous collapse. Mr. Waller was waiting by the railings near the pond, clad soberly in black, except for a tie of vivid crimson.
Here you are. Excellent. Comrade Prebble has already begun. I shall commence now that you have come.
A fair-sized crowd had already begun to collect. Comrade Prebble stood upon a small platform and addressed his listeners with a passionate earnestness. He was handicapped, however, by a recent tooth extraction, which meant he was not in full control of his consonants.
It is only when the whirlwind of the world are united,
When Mr. Waller began to speak, his audience consisted at first only of Smith, Mike and a fox terrier. Gradually, however, he attracted others. Lacking the dental problem which marked Comrade Prebble out as an entertainer, he made up for this by his activity. Whereas Prebble stood comparatively still, Mr. Waller behaved with the vivacity generally supposed to belong only to peas on shovels and cats on hot bricks.
Are born to lifelong servitude
as a dance
and put the
Smith, they are laughing at him.
So it seems. Fortunately, Comrade Waller is interpreting their derision as applause.
What can you do, comrades, to combat this oppression? You can give up the thing that oppresses you, the demon.
Oh dear, what? Comrade Waller has shifted from socialism to temperance. Never a good idea at one of these open-air events.
I take a beer
over
you any day, comrade.
What he needs is a bottle of gin over his head.
Look here, Smith. Can't we stop it? These chaps are getting fed up. They'll be going for him soon.
How can we switch off the flow? We can only sit tight, comrade, and look on.
The crowd was becoming more threatening every minute. A trio of young men of the loafer class who stood near Mike were especially fertile in comment. Smith's eyes were on Mr. Waller, but Mike was watching this group closely. Suddenly he saw one of them, a thick-set youth wearing a cloth cap and no collar, stoop. When he rose again, there was a stone in his hand. The sight acted on Mike like a spur. The man in the cloth cap raised his hand. Smith was impressed to witness Mike seizing the would-be marksman by the neck and hurling him to the ground. The crowd was instantly diverted. Mike's opponent had scrambled to his feet and was looking round for his assailant.
That's him, Bill.
He's the bloke what hit you, Bill.
Who are you, I should like to know?
Interpreting this correctly as a rhetorical question, Mike made no reply. Or rather, the reply he made was not verbal. A contented sigh went up from the crowd. Their Sunday afternoon was going to be spent just as they considered Sunday afternoons should be spent. Smith was instantly at Mike's side.
Give us your coat and don't go in for any fancy sparring. Switch it on, all you know, from the start.
Right.
I'll keep an eye open to see that none of his friends and relations join in.
I'll knock him down. I'll stamp him into the mud.
Bill, a surname unknown, stepped up. He was not one of your ultra-scientific fighters. He seemed to have modelled his style partly on a tortoise and partly on a windmill. Mike, on the other hand, stood upright and hit straight, with the result that he hurt his knuckles very much on his opponent's skull, with little obvious effect.
Hit him, Bill!
No good swinging your arms, Bill!
The two antagonists might have spent the rest of the afternoon in a mutual effort to merge their incompatible styles of combat had Bill's friends not decided to join in. One of them stepped up behind Mike and raised his walking stick. Even if he had been wearing his overcoat, a blow across the shoulders with a walking stick would have hurt. As Mike was in his jacket, it hurt more than anything he had ever experienced in his life.
Come here, you!
I've got him, comrade!
Oh! Smith, as pugilist, lacked something of the calm majesty which characterized him in the more peaceful moments of life. But nature had given him an enormous reach and a staccato jab remarkable in one so long and lean. The walking stick manipulator had the misfortune to charge straight into Smith's left fist. He spun round and sat down.
This is no place for us, Comrade Jackson. Shift ho, I think.
Quick, that way.
They dashed for the spot where the crowd was thinnest. The suddenness of the move gave them the start they needed. They reached the road. Some 50 yards ahead of them was a stationary tram. They hopped aboard.
Subject for a historical picture. Wounded leaving the field after the Battle of Clapham Common. How are your injuries, Warrior Jackson?
Oh, my back's hurting like blazes, and my ears all sore where that chap got me. You?
Physically, no. Spiritually, much. I am riding in a tram. I, Smith, have paid a penny for a ticket on a tram, if this should get around the clubs.
You can always get off.
No, he thinks of everything. Let us descend. I observe in the distance a cab. Let us go and parley with the driver.
The cab took them back to the flat where Mike, his back throbbing dully from the blow he had received, made the tea.
How pleasant after strife is rest. We shouldn't have appreciated this simple cup of tea had our sensibilities remained unstirred this afternoon.
Speak for yourself, Smith.
We can now sit at our ease like warriors after the fray, till the time comes for setting out to Comrade Waller's once more.
What? You don't mean to say we're going to sweat out to Clapham again?
But the cry has gone round the Waller household. Jackson and Smith are coming to supper. Already the fatted blancmange has been killed, and the table creaks beneath what's left of the midday beef.
Let it creak.
Don't you want to see how poor Comrade Waller is? He may have been lynched by that enthusiastic mob.
They were too busy with us.
Comrade Jackson, noblesse oblige.
All right, I'll come. But it's awful rot.
One of the many things Mike could never understand in Smith was his fondness for getting into atmospheres that were not his own. Mike, like most boys of his age, was never really at his ease, except in the presence of those of his own years and class. He was not a snob. He simply did not know what to talk to them about, unless they were cricket professionals. With them, he was never at a loss. Smith, on the contrary, seemed to be bored by them, and infinitely preferred talking to somebody who lived in quite another world.
What a treat it shall be. Comrade Waller, his friends and relations, the culinary delicacies, the persiflage.
The house where Mr. Waller lived was one of a row of semi-detached villas on the north side of the common.
Why, dear me, dear me. I've been wondering what happened to you. I was afraid those ruffians might have seriously injured you. When last I saw you, you were being...
chivied. Now, do not wrap the fact up in pleasant words. We were being chivied.
Goodness me.
We were legging it with the infuriated mob at our heels. An ignominious position for a Shropshire Smith, but, after all, Napoleon did the same.
Come in. Come in. You are most welcome.
Sunday supper, unless done on a large and informal scale, is probably the most depressing meal in existence. Spirituous liquor helps, and so does exhilarating conversation. Unfortunately, at Mr. Waller's table, there was neither.
This is Mr. Prebble. You've seen him in action this afternoon.
We certainly have.
Hello.
And my niece, Ada.
How do you do?
I'm Smith. The P is silent. Oh.
And Ada's fiancé, Mr. Richards.
Hello.
And this is Edward.
Edward was Mr. Waller's son. He was 10 years old and had the peculiarly loathsome expression which a snub nose sometimes gives to the young. Mr. Waller was a widower. After 5 minutes next to Edward, Mike felt strongly that Mrs. Waller was the lucky one.
Do you know the principal exports of Marseille?
What?
Do you know the principal exports of Marseille? I do.
Oh.
Yes. Do you know the capital of Madagascar?
No.
I do.
Oh.
Who was the first king of...
You mustn't worry, Mr. Jackson, Teddy. There are not many boys of his age, I can tell you, who could worry you with questions like that.
No, no, Comrade Jackson likes it. I always hold that much may be learned by casual chit-chat across the...
You don't know the capital of Madagascar.
Me?
Over to you, Comrade Edward.
I can tell you the kings of Israel, if you like. Do you know the kings of Israel?
Edward, be a good boy and let Mr. Jackson eat his supper.
Will you kindly pay the mother?
I beg your pardon?
Will you kindly pay the mother?
No.
The mustard.
The mustard, Preble?
Yes.
Yeah. Mr. Jackson, would you mind passing Comrade Preble the mustard?
Oh, sorry.
Mustard was first introduced to Peru by Cortez. Did you know that?
What? Sorry, how clumsy.
Spilled water all over the jam tart.
Hush, Edward.
I'm terribly sorry.
Edward distracted you, Mr. Jackson. He is always so eager to impart his knowledge.
Life can never be quite the same after you upset a water jug into an open jam tart at the table of a comparative stranger. Mike's nerve had gone. He ate on, but he was a broken man.
Why, Ada, dear, what's the matter? You're eating nothing. What's George been saying to you?
Thank you, Uncle Robert. There's nothing the matter. Nothing that Mr. Richards cares to say to me can upset me.
Mr. Richards?
Not now, Ada. I assure you, I never...
Oh, you never.
Richards? We happen to have a word or two on the way home from church on the subject of women's suffrage.
Oh, that fatal topic.
In Australia!
I was laughing and joking when all of a sudden she flew out at me. How was I to know she was so keen on the movement, Mr. Waller? You never told me.
In Australia?
I'll go and try to get her round. How was I to know?
Are you in favour of work for women?
He wants to know if you're in favour of votes for women. In Australia, they've got women's suffrage already. Did you know that?
After supper, the party retired to the drawing room. Edward was sent to bed, his parting shot to Mike a query about the hypotenuse and the square upon the same. Ada and Richards did not reappear. Smith and Mr. Waller became absorbed in conversation in a corner. Comrade Preble backed Mike into the opposite corner and treated him to what may have been a discourse on the rights of property. Mike began to realise that till now he had never known what boredom meant. There had been moments in his life which had been less interesting than other moments, but nothing to touch this for agony. Hours seemed to pass. Then he heard Smith saying goodbye to their host.
A remarkably intelligent boy, your Edward. You must let him come to tea at our flat one day.
Oh, thank you.
I may not be in myself. I have many duties which keep me away. But Comrade Jackson is sure to be there and will be delighted to chat with him.
Look here, Smith. If being your confidential secretary is going to let me in for any more of that sort of thing, you can jolly well accept my resignation.
The orgy was not to your taste.
What on earth did you land me with that man Preble for?
Land you? You were listening to him with bulging eyes, rapt attention. Do you mean to tell me, Comrade Jackson, that your appearance belied you?
Well, well, how we misread our fellow creatures.
Life in a bank is at its pleasantest in winter. When all the world outside is dark and damp and cold, the light and warmth of the place are comforting. The green shaded lamps look cosy. Mike was contented with his routine. He would arrive in the morning just in time to sign the attendance book. That was at 10 o'clock. From 10 to 11 he would potter. Mr. Waller even allowed him to stroll off to the postage department to visit Smith. From 11 to 12:30 he would put in a little gentle work. Lunch, unless there was a rush of business, could be spun out from 12:30 till 2. At 3:30 he would escape to the tea room for an hour with a novel. Then a final half hour of work or pottering until release at 5. By no means an unpleasant way of spending a late January day. One morning he noticed a curious change in Mr. Waller. The head of cash was always mildly cheerful on arrival and apt to relate the most recent sayings and doings of little Edward. On this particular day, however, the cashier was silent and absent-minded. Mike went round to postage to seek advice.
I say, Smith.
Comrade Jackson, The fight is beginning to be too much for me.
The fight?
After a grim struggle, I succeeded yesterday in inducing the man Bristow to abandon that rainbow waistcoat of his. Today, I enter the building, blithe and buoyant, and there is Comrade Bristow in a satin tie. Mm. It's hard, Comrade Jackson. It's hard, I tell you.
Look here, Smith. Could you go round to the cache and find out what's up with old Waller? He's sitting there looking absolutely fed up with things.
A touch of ennui, perhaps?
Worse than that. I'm afraid something really rotten has happened.
Smith is on the case. I shall reel round and make inquiries.
Smith departed and returned 10 minutes later, looking more serious than when he'd left.
It's little Edward. He's ill, poor chap. Pretty badly, too, from what I can gather. Pneumonia. Waller was up all night.
Poor man. He shouldn't have come in today.
Well, he's still in shock. Look here, you'd better nip back and do as much of the work as you can. Buck along.
Mike, as always, was rendered utterly dumb at the sight of suffering. He sat at his desk watching Mr. Waller at the counter. The habit of years enabled the cashier to work mechanically. Probably few of the people who came to cash checks suspected that there was anything wrong with the man who paid them their money. Most people look on the cashier of a bank as a sort of human slot machine. You put in your check and out comes money. It's no affair of yours whether life is treating the machine well or ill that day. Mike came to the office next morning prepared for a repetition of the previous day. He was amazed to find the cashier transformed.
My Edward has rallied, Mr. Jackson. Out of danger, the doctor says.
Oh, that is wonderful news, Mr. Waller.
Just before I left to catch the train, I heard him positively stumping Ada with a question about the 30 Years' War.
Oh, that's wonderful. Please, excuse me. I won't be a minute. I must tell Mr. Smith your good news.
The recovery of little Edward is indeed splendid, Comrade Jackson. It allows me to think of my own troubles.
Comrade Bristow?
Precisely. He blew into the office today in patent leather boots with white kid uppers. Add to that the fact that he is still wearing the satin tie, the rainbow waistcoat, and the ring. I have decided to abandon all hope of his reform.
By the end of the morning, Mike had heard quite enough about Edward, his doings, his sayings, his prospects. He never wished to hear the name Edward again. Now, we do not claim originality for the statement that things don't happen quite as one expects them to, but once the crisis of Edward's pneumonia had passed, Mike had looked forward to a series of days unbroken by any but the minor troubles of life. Then he happened to look up and see Mr. Waller emerging from the manager's office. The cashier was deadly pale. His walk, the same limp, crushed walk which Mike had seen when Edward's safety still hung in the balance.
Jackson.
Mr. Waller.
Do you remember a cheque coming through yesterday for £100 with Sir John Morrison's signature?
Yes. It came in the morning, rather late.
Mike remembered the cheque owing to the amount, three figures. It had been presented just before the cashier had gone out to lunch. He recollected the man who had presented it, a tallish man with a beard. He had noticed him particularly because of the contrast between his manner and that of Mr. Waller. The former had been so very cheery and breezy, the latter so dazed and silent.
It was a forgery.
A forgery?
A forgery. And a clumsy one. Oh, it's hard. I should have seen it on any other day. Mr. Bickersdyke showed me the cheque in there just now. I don't remember the cheque or anything about it yet. There it is.
Once more, Mike was tongue-tied. For the life of him, he could find nothing to say.
Sir John is in there now with Mr. Bickersdyke. They're both furious. I shall be dismissed. Mr. Bickersdyke has wanted to get rid of me for a long time. He never liked me. I shall be dismissed. What can I do? I'm an old man. I can't make another start. I'm good for nothing. Nobody will take an old man like me.
Mike sat staring miserably in front of him. Then, quite suddenly, an idea came to him. He saw a way out. It was a curious, crooked way, but at that moment it stretched clear and broad before him. He felt light-hearted and excited, as if he were watching the development of some interesting play at the theatre. He walked up the aisle to Mr. Bickersdyke's room and opened the door. What he was about to do would be inconvenient for him in the short term, but he was young. He was fit. Mr. Waller had been kind to him, and now he desperately needed his help.
Excuse me, Mr. Bickersdyke. I have come to explain about Mr. Waller and the cheque. It wasn't him. I was at the counter when it was brought in. It was me. I cashed it.
Mike returned from Mr. Bickersdyke's office in a dazed condition. He had expected, when he went to the manager's room to make his statement, that he would be dismissed. But he had not expected the great frothing wave of verbal denunciation that had spewed over him. Mr. Bickersdyke, a veteran of political debates, had thundered as though Mike had been His Majesty's government or the encroaching alien. He was sitting at his desk and had gnawed his way through one-third of a penholder when Smith arrived.
It has reached me that you and Comrade Bickersdyke have been seen doing the Hackenschmidt Gotch act on the floor. Is this so?
I did it for Mr. Waller.
So I gather. Meanwhile, your good turn has landed you with a splash in the very centre of the Oxo.
Well, why not? I'm young, a free agent, no ties.
No ties? You happen to be confidential adviser to a Shropshire Smith.
Excuse me. Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Waller.
There are no words adequate to what I am feeling.
Oh.
To think that you would be brave enough, generous enough, to get me reinstated.
Well.
You have quite simply given me back my life, my future. But there is one thing I can offer you.
Say on, Comrade Waller.
Supper in Clapham. Just me and you and little Edward.
Ah, you must forgive Comrade Jackson. He is quite overcome.
Oh, so I see. A man of immense sensitivity. Edward and I shall expect you next Friday at 7.
As the ancients had it, no good deed ever goes unpunished.
I should have seen it coming. I should have booked my passage to South America.
Nonsense. You are needed here at the New Asiatic. I intend to take up this little affair with Comrade B.
Look here, Smith. There's no earthly need for you to get plugged into this. I'm happy to leave the bank.
Are you really?
Yes. Ecstatic, in fact. Anyway, I did it for Mr. Waller. He's a good egg.
As are you, Comrade Jackson. The very best egg I know.
In episode 3 of Smith in the City by P.G. Woodhouse, dramatised by Marcy Cahan, Woodhouse was played by Simon Williams. Smith was Nick Caldicott and Mike Inam Mirza. Mr. Waller was played by Jonathan Taffler and Edward Waller by Ryan Watson. Comrade Preble was played by Chris Pavlo and Ada by Jill Carter. Bill and Richards were played by Dan Starkey and the plebeians on Clapham Common were Stephen Critchlow and Robert Lonsdale. Original music was by Clive Swift. Smith in the City was directed by Abigail Lefleur.